The electrical co-op recently made some pretty strong strategic move, and that is going toward broadband. And all of you talked about the importance of fulfilling voids because of coal mining, power plants, and whatnot. Do you think that was a good move on Yampa Valley Electric's part? Because it does drive a lot of things. We've heard stories of young people can't get they can't get enough internet, and they can't get their homework done, and they moms and dads drive their kids to McDonald's and whatever. So that was a very robust discussion within Yampa Valley Electric, and I just wondered what you all think about that move, because that takes a lot of money, and that money is now not available to do some of the things that people want us to do. So just throwing it out there, I'd like to hear what you all think about that.
I have four kids. Broadband is essential. They're going to school, they have to get on the internet for their homework. I live out in the sagebrush, so to get internet connection out in the sagebrush, in the years I've been here, I've switched four different internet companies because of poor service, expense, and we just switched a couple weeks ago. They're tied. I mean, to get an education nowadays, you need broadband at home or some way of having that. So to make that decision, in my opinion, that's huge. I work with a lot of counties on wildland fires. As soon as you have a big fire, you'll bring in an incident management team, and the first thing they ask is, do you have a broadband connection? Do you have everything hooked up? We've got to get satellite. We've got to pull down all the weather. You'll bring in a meteorologist, and the first thing they need to know is, how fast is the internet so I can watch the radar all the time? It's a lifestyle. It's not just in the cities. It's everywhere. And it's kind of weird. I've been out in the middle of, I call it dismal seepage Nevada, and there's no place like that. But next thing you know, you'll see a city of firefighters out there, and you'll see satellites and generators, and broadband will be there because the internet is essential.
Now, actually, I shouldn't be asking a question, but I meant to bring this up in our discussion. When we looked at how these rural electric co-ops came about, do you see any parallels between that, bringing electricity out to rural areas, and now in the 21st century with the broadband? Do you see parallels there?
Yeah, for sure.
I'll say absolutely. Living on a place outside of town, we're in a place that we're in a shadow for anything that's, you know, the point-to-point type systems. And so it's essential. And how education is working, a lot of reliance comes from having kids have access to the internet. There were a couple years that we did not have good internet, and we would bring them down here to the granary because we could be able to use the internet here.
Yeah. Also, the broadband is essential for any new businesses or to attract any type of new industry. It's absolutely essential. I'm totally supportive of YVA taking it. It was a big relief to us in Moffat County. Very, very helpful, and looking forward to that as it gets rolled out and what it can do for everything we're trying to develop.
I know that we are very appreciative that you all are doing that. I think, as you know, the last mile stuff is really hard, very expensive. Historically, not that it's that long of history with broadband, but you know, we've really had to try to convince companies like CenturyLink that it makes sense for them to do this, and it doesn't. It doesn't make business sense for them to do it. And so I think the YVEA is very uniquely, and other electric co-ops, I'm sure as well, very well situated to be able to do this, and we appreciate having a local business that understands the community, that's committed to the community, really doing this work. And we are excited to partner on some of that, because
without public funding, it's hard to make it make business sense either. And so, you know, we've been supportive of grants that you all have applied for and really trying to do whatever we can to make that happen. And the reality within Rout County is that it makes the most sense to build more internet where there's already access, you know, to start where the population is, which is in Steamboat. But the people who really need it, who are the people who don't have access. It's the people in Clark, you know, it's the people out in Toponas and in Yampa. And so we're excited that you all are doing that work. And then I also realized, I believe this year there was a bill that went through the legislature to allow you all to access your own easements for the purpose of broadband. Am I correct about that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
And so that is huge and seems like a no-brainer, right? You have easements for your electric lines, and it did require the state legislature to pass legislation to allow you to access the easements you have for electric to utilize those for fiber and for broadband access. So again, seems obvious and like a great step forward. So thank you all for taking that on.
I am interested in sort of the shift in community values as this transition takes place. And I wonder if anybody can speak to solar purveyors and the amount of land that might be required and space just to put together solar farms. I mean, is that part of the vision? And could that augment or somehow complement agriculture that we already have that can be used in a dual role? Has it been considered, just because agriculture is so strong here and such a vital part of the economy and the community, can somebody speak to that duality and the potential? Thank you.
Start us off, please. So a couple different things you mentioned there. I think one aspect is in terms of space, solar panels are becoming more and more and more efficient. And I actually met someone in one of the, the art walk at Steamboat. And a gentleman came up and was very proud of his 30-watt panels he's had for like 30 years. By the way, those panels are now up to 350 watts. And it's the same size panel, but now is many, many times more efficient. And while sometimes it makes sense to pin solar in the field, there's also a ton of opportunity to put on our rooftops and other locations we tend to not use a lot. So that's one aspect of just like the sizing of it. The other aspect is I have talked to a lot of folks in the agriculture industry in terms of the values that solar can bring. It provides a little extra resilience. So if you're at the end of the line and you're suspect to brownouts or any other issues, provides that extra capacity. Storage as well, starting to change the dynamics. And when we look at the trends of the pricing of storage, they're coming down as rapidly as solar has in the last several years. And so we'll see that catching up economically as well. And one thing we didn't talk about, but at Solar Energy International, which is our partner that we work with for the solar trainings, one of the pieces of curriculum that they do is you plug in a solar panel directly into a direct current water pump, and it is amazing. You get this panel, it just has this huge current of water that comes out, and you don't need any other equipment. So just as long as the sun's out, you're pumping water. And so there are really easy ways to incorporate solar, whether it's that or LED lights or other ways to incorporate that in agriculture space. And we're really excited to see from Solar United Neighbors, like, are there ways that we can support that and do other maybe specialized co-ops to purchase such equipment.
I'd also say too, it comes down to the siting of solar as well. Obviously, you'd never want to take a productive hay field and blanket it with solar and take away that productivity. But you know, putting things like the Craig Solar Garden, which currently exists, is sited on land, which is at the I believe it's the old wastewater. Yeah, I should actually know what that was. I was trying to think there. But anyways, you never want to use land that could be used for something else, right? You know, that's land that you could never grow a crop on, something like that. You know, repurposing lands that really don't have a better purpose and sort of actually gaining more value than it just sitting there, you know? So I think that's definitely an important consideration. But obviously, I think that's definitely not the intent, is to take land that has an already existing or superior use and sort of consuming that land for a solar field, but getting things to work in conjunction and getting things to work in a smart way that's yeah, the best use of that land. Yep.
But. So there are big time land use implications when we start talking about renewables. And here in Route County, there are a few things that we try to protect and preserve in our land use planning that if we were to try to create renewable resources here, renewable energy sources on a mass scale, we would really bump up against some of those things that we're trying to preserve. So when we talk about, we preserve the landscape, we preserve our view sheds, we really preserve agricultural uses on our lands. And so these are real challenges. And the other thing that you really have to talk about when you're talking about renewables on a mass scale with regards to land use is transmission lines. And where are those going to go? And who wants those running through their backyard? You know, the reality is that humans require a lot of energy to survive. And none of those are without sin, if you will. There are real challenges to every type of energy that we try to produce. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. And when I was growing up, the big conversation was whether we should remove dams to save fish. And recently I was home and wind production has become huge, and driving through these rural landscapes, you're in the middle of nowhere. And I took a picture because it was so surreal to come over a hill and you're in the middle of nowhere and suddenly there are thousands of windmills. And so when we talk about some of the things that we're trying to protect and preserve in terms of the character of our community and some of the character elements that we believe really contribute to the strength of our economy, those are things we also definitely have to be thinking about and talking about when we're talking about these things on a mass scale.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate the comment because I think that's important for us all to keep in our mind to protect what we can with the experience of coming to the Yampa Valley, right? The agritourism is a huge asset. I think that's something we're going to be able to develop the whole valley through. So we certainly wouldn't want to put solar panels or windmills that would destroy that. And I think that's something we're mindful. I appreciate you bringing the comment up to make sure it is in everyone's thoughts when we're discussing this, because we sure don't want to, you know, cancel out one great industry for a different one. And we don't want to be dependent on one industry again either.
I think there's one good fact I would bring up, though, too, in relation to that. There was a study done, and this was actually back in 2016, that it would actually only take 0.6% of the continental land in the United States to power the entire country just from solar. And obviously, I don't think that's ever the goal, is to just switch to one energy source. But I think it's also surprisingly small amount of land use that actually can produce a very significant amount of energy. But yes, obviously, citing these in locations that aren't going to be used for anything else, aren't interfering with the visual impacts and the other attractiveness of our state, and you know, definitely being smart about it. But that is one thing that I thought was really interesting. It's a surprising small amount of land to produce very significant amounts of power. But yeah, just one statistic. Yep.
The comment I wanted to make is what came to my mind as I was listening to the drift is that, you know, you talk about the possibility of a fairly major change, like shutting down a regional power plant, and whether it's a power plant or a car manufacturing facility in the Midwest or whatever, it's a big thing. You know, in Bryce's opening comments, he was showing the map of the territory that the REAs helped to begin to serve. It's, you know, it was a massive thing. And I think, you know, it seems like what's driving, also as you had in your opening slides, is not so much, well, there's clearly environmental issues going on, but coal is waning simply because it's no longer the cheapest next alternative, leave alone, you know, some of the environmental issues. But rural electrification created a whole industry, you know, and it seems to me that while rooftop solar, as represented by the Solar United Neighbors, is one of the steps, that it's still a massive issue, and that the utility industry, you know, is the big player there that somehow needs to stay a partner. And some of you have spoken to that, but it just seems to me that it's a sufficiently massive issue that it's going to take an industry to respond, maybe nudged by Solar United Neighbors, you know, here, there, and everywhere. But it just seems like it's a place where the utility industry that's been created, if it steps up, you know, it took a leadership role a century ago, and it needs to take a leadership role this coming century. So I guess that's more by way of observation and comment than a question. It just seems like it's been said that the next time you might hold such a panel discussion, that others should be at the table. Others should be at the table, is my comment.
And I think one thing to build off in terms of what you shared is, you know, I think municipalities and co-ops are in a unique position because they're able to directly serve their community and their needs when it comes to energy, because it's community owned. And when you look at investor owned utilities, I think it's worth acknowledging, for instance, in the case of Xcel Energy, with the renewal of the Public Utilities Commission, now they're basically guaranteed to maintain control of 50% of the grid for the next 20 years. And that's also an opportunity for distributed generation and opportunity for energy dollars to stay local. But I think that's part of the conversation as we see these transitions and we see the role that rooftop solar has, we see the role that larger solar projects and other distributed generation projects have. It's also who's going to own it? Who's going to get the benefits of it? Where is it going to be sited? And who can take advantage of that? And we didn't talk much about it, but I think thinking about equity and what, especially making sure access of low to medium income families have the benefits of solar as well. And that's part of this challenge as well, is looking at as solar gets deployed and as companies take on this challenge, making sure we don't leave those folks behind too.
This is in a whole different vein. When coal was first in the Hayden area, Hayden was a whole lot more diverse. And over my lifetime, I've watched Hayden become more white, just to put it bluntly. And I've watched, and this is from my own experience, and maybe from raising a child of color. I've watched this community become a whole lot less diverse and a whole lot less welcoming to people who are not white. So I'm wondering, when you talk about millennials, I think it's a very strong value of mine and of the millennials that I know to raise their children, to grow up, to be in a place that is tolerant of difference and is diverse. So I'm wondering, in all these various initiatives, and I know we've mainly talked about economics, but if you want to draw people to this area, I really think we need to think about how we become more inclusive.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Inclusive excellence is actually one of my personal mantras I live by, and I try to put that into every work I do. Lucky enough to come out of a higher education where I had a lot of training and work with students. And very candid conversations on race and inclusion, and so you hit the nail on the head. It's a huge issue here, and I think it's a good thing to be bringing up, and I think it's something we need to talk about more, and how can we integrate this in with our policies and our solutions. Absolutely, we want to bring in remote workers. we need them all to feel welcome, right? Wherever they're coming from. So I think that is something we need to do more with.
Sort of go back to a couple of things that were said. Just remember that large solar has to be built, not only that it's not seen, but also we have to find a way to get transmission out of it. And that's a big and expensive cost. We've had, and where I'm really going here is that I would recommend that you really make a partnership with Yamp Valley Electric instead of looking at Yamp Valley Electric as being the obstacle. I don't think it is. I think the partnership is the most important thing. I'll give you two examples. We've had a couple of folks come to us, do a megawatt of solar is about $1 million. Someone came to us, said, we have some land we'd like to donate. We want to put a whatever. We're going to spend $1 million, probably more. By the time we figured out how we're going to get transmission lines back to a source where we can actually get into the infrastructure, it was $2 million more that killed the project just like that. So it's very important to work with a co-op. We currently are looking at a 2-megawatt system that someone is interested in. They're doing it in the right way. They've contacted Yamp Valley Electric, Yamp Valley Engineering, and we're going out and looking at the location, and we're doing a quick study on, is this feasible or is it not? Instead of someone saying, I just want to donate the land and do it, and then we can't do it, and Yamp Valley Electric gets the black eye because we refused. And that's the kind of stuff that we really would like to be able to be your partners with anybody about any issues instead of, you know, the other way. So that's what I would ask.
And I should add full disclosure, Tom Fox is with Yamp Valley Electric, so she should know that. You didn't mention that when you were doing And Patrick is one of our newest directors.
Yes, he is. We're excited.
I was going to ask Tom to talk a little bit more about, you know, when you look at rooftop solar and some of the things that make solar at your home, whether you're doing 50% or 80% or 100% solar, you know, how it integrates back with Yampa Valley Electric. So can you talk a little bit about what YVA has done to make that happen?
Well, it's, and I don't, and I'm not sure, you guys probably know it more than I, but I believe that, first of all, rooftop solar, I don't think you usually run into an obstacle with Yamp Valley Electric, providing it's a certain size or less. That's mandated by, I believe, state statute, correct? So a house with rooftop solar, as long as it isn't more than 25 kW, whatever, there's no problems at all. It's when you become, when you go over a certain threshold, now they consider it a supplier, and then we have to go to Xcel Energy. We have a, you know, so whatever. So if that helps you.
Right, I'm talking more about like AMI and those kinds of things that have been invested in. It's already out there, it's in there, so if somebody wants to put 25 kW on their roof, they can do it because of the systems that are already in place.
That is correct. AMI is only about a year old, and we're still working out the, please? Yeah. Jargon. Oh yeah, automatic metering infrastructure is right. A lot of people think that all it is to read the meter easily, and we can turn the power off back at the home base and turn it back on. There is so much more to it. We really need it. We need the AMI. We can find out when people are out of power before they know they're out of power, and we're already on the road and rolling to it. We can tell. If it's between here and here, we're going to tell there's a fault right there. Whereas we used to have to take snowmobiles and trucks at night with flashlights and drive the line to try to find out where it is. And sometimes there's 20 miles between a reset switch and another reset switch. So it's really good for that. And what Patrick is also talking about is we can control our substations for, you know, resetting. We can do it with a computer now. We used to have to go out there with a long stick in a snowstorm and reset our switching. So there's a lot to it. We had a fairly robust discussion about AMI because we had a couple of new board members, but it's so important. It does so much more, and no, Big Brother is not watching every move you're making. All we know is when your power is on and when it's off, and if it's the right voltage, because voltage is pretty, we have an engineer here, voltage is pretty important as well. We've heard of all kinds of electricity is a spin and there's a push, and we can see it all, and before we couldn't see any of it. Does that help at all, or I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
In order to do some of these things that we're doing with solar, you know, YVA really is a partner in that, and, you know, has invested tens of millions of dollars in this to make it ready so that we can all plug into the system.
Yeah, and well, say for context that I know, what we see in a lot of communities that get to a certain saturation of solar, so like Hawaii, for instance, California, where you start getting to that 10% point, it puts a lot of stress on the grid if you're not prepared. It puts a lot of stress on the transformers if you're not able to upgrade them. We actually had a, for us generally, most of our systems are under 25 kilowatts. We actually got a 32 kilowatt system in Fort Collins, and they worked with us, and for the labor of the installer, they upgraded a transformer to accommodate that house that was building that system. And so using technology like AMI and then also pairing it with the transformers, as solar saturation grows, like you guys are already being so preemptive and can be prepared for that growth.
This is Jim Jennings. I do just have a question about that. When you're talking about with the co-op, are you talking about individual rooftop solar or yard solar or not community solar?
Correct.
Okay.
As of now, we're not directly involved with community solar, but it's something that we've gone, for those that their roofs or yards may not qualify, if they're not interested, we definitely want to offer community solar as an alternative, but that's a referral aspect of it, not something that we ourselves are going to try to build or anything like that. And based on what you're saying, I'm sure some of those same folks have reached out to us with some of those megawatt projects, and, you know, that's we offer consulting, but that's definitely something that is much more collaborative and everyone should be talking about to figure out if it's even feasible.
Solar does not work without our local co-op, you know? It's absolute necessity to all be together in this, because no one wants to fill their basement with $100,000 worth of batteries, you know?
Other comment I just wanted to make is this is not the first time this area has gone through a huge transition. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when that, before the power plant was here and before there were strip mines, right? And when, you know, people were moaning and groaning about the closure of Mount Harris. I'm old enough to remember the houses coming mm-hmm. down the yep. highway to move into Hayden to, when mm-hmm. Mount Harris collapsed or went into bankruptcy and they sold all the houses mostly to Hayden. So we've been through that before. And you mentioned this independence, right? Well, there's also a very strong tradition here of people helping one another and of being flexible, you know? I mean, you're a classic example of that. You know, I'm a firefighter, but hey, I could do solar. You know, I would assume, you know, maybe people will grieve for a while, right? And certainly those jobs mm-hmm. at the plant are really high paying and they have a lot of benefits. But they're going to be ready to, you know, move. You can't live here and just do one thing or be only good at one thing, you know? You gotta know how to do a lot of things. And so I think that's the other question is like, what do you want to do? But what have you been doing that you might be able to expand on? Like, what are your strengths that we can help you build? Rather than, oh, poor you, this deficiency right. model.
Yep.
And I think, especially Hayden has always felt deficient. You know, ever since they weren't the county seat, and Steamboat got it. They've been, you know, boo-hoo about,
it, for real.
Oh, poor us, you know?
Shift from a victim mentality.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But fundamentally, people are pretty sturdy. And if mm-hmm. you draw on that, they'll be able to make that change. So, I mean, we've been through it before. If you need some gray hair people to tell people about that.
I cut all mine off. Just so you can't tell all of them.
You know, yeah, the other thing about this, people need time to adjust. Oh, yeah. You know, and that's part about repetition. I mean, it's suspenseful, and I think people are going to be engaged. Hey, if the power plant goes, then what? You know, again, old enough to remember, it was like,
oh, the power plant's coming, now what the hell's going to happen, you know? And Colorado Humanities Project did a whole long-term thing, town meetings for the boomtown here. And we had 60, 80 people there. But it was also walking door to door saying, hey, this town's changing. You want to be part of it? What do you want to save? What's important? And people showed up. I mean, we filled the whole gym at the high school for those meetings. And there were 7 of them, and they lasted all winter. But people really got in there and, you know, pitched in to try to figure out what was going to happen. This is Hayden, 1977, maybe?
I swear I did not intend to have like an action item at this event, but to keep like those interests to like figure this out.
Yeah, and I think you got to pass the hat for that $22 million. I mean, I think that should be part of their closure plan to help the school not leave the school district in the lurch.
Yes.
That they're sucking away all that property tax. You know, it's not just the jobs. It is the property valuation. Mm-hmm. And could they, you know, make a commitment like golden parachute type of thing to help this district?
And maybe that's
just an idea.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And maybe that's the context of the next conversation is like, what's the community covenant that we want to hold up? If you're leaving our community, here's what we're asking you to provide us. And I know I have a friend of mine that works for Governor Polis, and he said that they're looking for communities that collaborate. And the more collaboration there is within the community, the more attention from the governor that there's going to be. And based on the Department of Local Affairs and the fact that they've been aggressively outreaching to this area with the $12 million of renewable energy funding, they're already saying that this is a high priority. So it seems like right now the stars are aligned to take full advantage of this and get everything that you possibly can get out of this conversation. And everything from securing the school to workforce training to a tourist program. You know, let's get some new PR.
I mean, coming back to this, the school issue, we're talking about trying to attract this millennial generation who is educated. This is what we've gone through in the Grand Junction area as well. We passed our mill and bond. And that was a big selling point of it is you're not going to attract those people to your community unless you can show that you've got a good school system. Mm-hmm. And so in order to keep areas economically vital, you've got to, that's a major piece of that.
I've seen the impacts that a group like this can do. So for full disclosure, I wasn't sure if it was going to come up tonight, but I'll just share. So my past life, I was Sierra Club. And my campaign I've worked on was the Ready for 100 campaign. And going to places like Pueblo, seeing the downtrodden, seeing the challenges they have with their economy, they really were lacking vision and felt pretty hopeless. And so as we came in and we hired a staffer, because we knew bigger picture, like if Pueblo can do it, it's not just a Boulder, it's not just an Aspen, but Pueblo, that's going to revolutionize the conversations that are happening. Knowing all the while, all those graphs, those trends are already happening. And so being able to have, like, I mean, ultimately we ended up with a core team of maybe like 10, 15 people just like this, that then mobilized another couple hundred people over a year, doing information events, educational outreach, bringing on council members, commissioners, and ultimately not only did the city make a commitment, that commitment led to Governor Polis's campaign to say, hey, look at Pueblo's goal, let's do other goals. And pretty soon we developed a network of, you know, 5-10 communities that made these commitments, which then moved Excel to say, okay, we're going to go 100%. And so I think this work is still happening, but now it's less about the commitments, but now it's about how do we do it right, and how do we do it right here? And so it all comes down to a circle just like this and saying, you know what, let's work on this and make this vision happen. And I've seen this happen time and time again, and I think you guys are probably the best position that I've ever seen the community to, frankly, kick ass. And that's my little speech, but like, I'm really, going back to optimistic, like I'm really excited because I think you guys have an opportunity to do something amazing for this region.